Spring is here and baseball is back.
You can't forget the Derby. I love the hats. Do you have yours yet?
My hat? I treated myself to a whole outfit.
If you want to be able to treat yourself, then you should check out the Nest Savings Account at LGE Community Credit Union, where they want you to reach your savings goals faster.
Take it from a pair of 680 The Fan wives. Head to lgeccu.org to find out what makes their team number one in Georgia.
If you're in downtown Alpharetta, go see my friends Travis and Andy at Turinga. They're located in City Center, and if you're going anywhere for spring break, summer break, or fall break, go see the sister restaurant Turinga at Grayton Beach across from the world-famous Red Bar.
This is the Ben Burnett Show, the only show in America that features a one-term has-been retired politician that nobody knows.
Welcome into the Ben Burnett Show. My name is Ben Burnett. My guest today is doctor or commander, I'll let you choose, Rich McCormick. Rich, welcome in.
Thanks. Good to be here. Appreciate you.
So, little background on Rich for those of you sitting at home, which most of you are sitting at home. Rich spent over a decade in the United States Marine Corps, was a helicopter pilot, decided that he wanted to become a doctor or a physician. He's been in all kinds of forward areas all over planet Earth, Horn of Africa, Afghanistan, Iraq. And I want to thank Ryan at Parlay and Jay Williams and Andrew Lajeunesse at Stone Ridge for convincing you that I was not a total waste of time. So, Commander, welcome in.
Thanks. Good to be here. I'm excited about this this election coming up. It's going to be a great freshman class. A record number of women, minorities, veterans. It's not lost on me the historical perspective of what we can accomplish. And really, if we take 34 seats, we'll have the largest majority since the Great Depression. So much will be expected of us, at least in stopping the madness until we can get the presidency back.
So you are today an emergency room physician when you're not campaigning full time, and you are a husband and father of seven. Did you miss the day in medical school where they talked about birth control?
So I had all my kids prior to medical school.
So you were a real glutton for punishment.
That's right. Actually, interesting story. When I went to medical school, I was a newly minted single father of three little boys, 2, 3, and 5 years old when I started medical school. The reason I chose Morehouse School of Medicine is because it was the closest school to where I lived, and I needed to be close to my support network because obviously being a single parent of three little boys is not an easy thing as a medical student. Now, my ex-wife lived near there. My church was near there. It was just a better scenario. So I went to Morehouse based on proximity, but it ended up being a blessing for me. Morehouse, I had taught at Morehouse College and Georgia Tech. That's where I did. Georgia Tech is where I did my pre-med. I was also part of the AUC, so Spelman, Clark Atlanta, Morris Brown before it went defunct. So I was very familiar with that campus anyways. Most people realize that Morehouse College, it's all male, and about 98% black. If you go to Morehouse School of Medicine, it's 60% female, about 80% black, and about 95% liberal. And although I know we can identify as anything we want to now, I am not a black liberal female.
And you were the student body president.
Yes. So that happened my fourth year. You know, this is right after Obama was elected president of the United States. My peers selected me as a student body president. And this goes more to the point of where we're going in politics. First of all, realize that relationships trump politics.
Always.
And if we can have a conversation where we can win with authentic relationships, win over people who are naturally conservative. And I believe most minorities are naturally conservative. You're seeing a huge swing of the Hispanic votership coming over to the Republican Party because they're naturally. They're religious, just like the black community. Religious, moral people, hardworking people. They just need opportunity. And the American government, mainly the liberals, have been lying to them saying, look, we're going to give you things and it's going to make you successful. Nothing ever given to you. It makes you successful. It's what you earn that makes you successful. The opportunities can create an environment where you can be more successful. And there's the dirty little secret. As a matter of fact, I'm going to reveal a few dirty little secrets I'm going to be harping on for the next however long I'm in politics, for the rest of my life, for that matter. First of all, when they talk about punishing billionaires, this hypocritical idea that Democrats are somehow against rich people, they're funded by rich people. Let's face it.
Almost always.
They have way more money than we do. Their candidates have way more money. It's not because of small dollar donors. It's because they have billionaires that have super PACs. When I went in my last election, Bloomberg dropped $1.5 million against me in the last 3 weeks of my campaign. And that's just one race that he was in. He spent $1 billion just in one election cycle. This guy's worth about $11 billion, which sounds like a lot, but of course...
Like me going to lunch with you.
That's right. And what's interesting is way more billionaires give way more money to Democrats than Republicans. So it's a dishonest argument to start with. Secondly, the Democrats aren't interested in solving minorities' problems. They're interested in making them reliant on a government system so they continue to vote a Democrat, and it's never helped them out of poverty. As a matter of fact, that's why a lot of people are starting to finally wake up after a couple generations now, where they've said, oh, this is going to work for us, and it doesn't. It doesn't get them out of poverty. It doesn't help them with equality. It doesn't get rid of racism. You cannot make a law that gets rid of racism. Racism is something that you get rid of by going to church together, eating meals together, having authentic relationships together. It is not going to be solved by government. As a matter of fact, it is absurd that we keep on turning to the government to solve the very problems that they created. And thirdly, the Democrats are never done giving away your money. Never. If we gave them everything they're asking for this year, whether it be free education, free medical, free whatever.
They'd find something else.
Next year, they would be back with a bigger list because they'd have to have something else to promise the people to get them to vote for them. Otherwise, there's no reason to vote for them. They're not good for business. They're not good for taxation. They're not good for regulation. They're not good for freedoms. They are on the wrong side of history. And we need to reclaim our history, by the way. We are the ones that fought for equal rights. We are the ones that led the way to opportunity. We are the ones that led for freedoms and the prosperity that has benefited America for a couple hundred years. And anytime you want to turn back to government to be the leader in whatever opportunities you have, I go back to what founded this nation. We broke away from one person calling all the shots of a government overriding people. That's what our nation is founded on. That's why we are unique, when we empower the people over a government. And that's what this whole fight is about. When we allow businesses to choose who they hire and fire, how they spend their money, whether they wear masks, whether they're open, whether they get vaccinations, when you're in charge of your life, it universally turns out better than when the government's in charge. And if it doesn't, who do you have to blame? You.
Where does it come from? When you're growing up, where did you grow up?
So I was born in Vegas.
Nice.
Grew up.
Different town to grow up and then visit.
That's right. My dad was a deputy sheriff there. We moved to Oregon, a very conservative place called Portland, Oregon.
The most.
Yeah, that's right. Matter of fact, my wife was just commenting last night. She watches all those murder shows, you know, where people.
Dateline
and all that stuff. And it seems like about half.
They're in Portland.
Half the episodes are in Portland. I'm not sure why, but yeah, there's some crazies up there. But it didn't seem like that when I was growing up. I don't remember it being so politically charged as it is now. Everybody's become so hypersensitive to politics. And I think part of the problem is because people are very unhappy with where our country is going. And the more left we go, by the way, the more people get hyperverbal and up at arms because they see us going towards a Marxist government. The parties have diverged right now. It used to be when John Kerry was debating George Bush, which, by the way, that was the first time I ever paid attention to a presidential debate because I didn't care about politics when I was in the military. But I remember
You're not really allowed to.
Right. That's well. You're supposed to. You're leading people of all different kind of backgrounds, and it's really you need to stay your lane. You need to focus on the military mission accomplishment. As long as the government stays out of your way, by the way, that's part of command staff. That's part of the war college. Is realizing that politicians typically ruin wars. They really do. They politicize them and then they go to hell. And that's why, first of all, we haven't declared war by the congressional way, in other words, by the Constitution, since World War II.
Yeah, I was going to say since probably the early 40s.
And so we've politicized wars in the way we prosecute them and the way that we declare them.
Well, and they fought them differently too.
And that's why we keep on losing.
Do you, when you make the decision from an education standpoint, where did you go to college?
So I went to Oregon State for my bachelor's of science.
Are you a beaver?
Yeah. So I graduated. Yeah, that powerhouse Pac-10 at the time, now Pac-12.
Corvallis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I did my MBA at National University in California. And then I did that night school. And then I got my, of course, my medical degree through Morehouse.
What, when you make the decision leaving Oregon State to, I don't get a lot of West Coast guys. I'm one. When you make the decision to go into the military, what factored into that, and how did you, did you go to flight school in Pensacola with the rest of with the rest of the country and decided you were going to give them 8 years? Did you know you wanted to fly helicopters? Did you want to fly cargo planes? Did they tell you what you were flying?
So the story of Rich McCormick started with a poor kid who literally just thought it was, I just trying to make a buck. You know, when I was in middle school, I was picking berries in the fields with the migrant workers, became a bus boy because it was a lot more lucrative, you know, after I had my paper out, back when it was legal to have a paper out for little kids. And then I became a short order cook, and I was enlisted in the Army. Actually, was 17 years old. My mom signed the papers for me to enlist in the Army. Army Airborne. That was my plan. Felt very drawn towards the military. It was a kind of a way out, but also you hear the beat of the drum. If you would ask me when I was younger what I wanted to be, I was like, man, being a McDonald's manager would be highly successful. Those were the people in my group that were successful. I wasn't from a rich family. My mom was a single mom since the time I was about 3 years old. She was a secretary. She didn't care about academics, didn't care about sports. I think she would have been happy if I became a priest. I'm not a priest. That didn't work out. So really had to find my way. I'm from a military family. I'm a third generation military pilot. Was going to go and enlist in the Army. And then all of a sudden I saw that movie Top Gun. And I literally wasn't going to get a college. I only applied to one college as a social studies assignment. But I saw that movie Top Gun. It changed my life. I'm like, how do you do that? They say you got to be go to college.
You got to go to school for 4 years.
So never took academics very seriously. But I realized in order to achieve that, I had to go to college. I went to college. But all the people that impressed me there were Marines. They're more hardcore, more fit, more dedicated to each other. And the Marines are like an island of broken toys. They're people that a lot of times don't have the greatest family background, but when you find your mates in the Marine Corps, it's your family. Like literally you take a bullet for them. Your friends are literally like brothers. My youngest son is named after my two best friends in the Marine Corps. They're uncles to my sons. I would trust my wife, my riches, my anything with those guys. And likewise, they would do the same thing with me. And so when we joined the Marine Corps, and by the way, those are the guys that made me realize my potential. First of all, didn't take college very seriously. For me to go into medical school is crazy. All this was really meant to be. All my greatest achievements, I truly cannot take credit for. I got to believe that there's a higher power involved. I believe in God Almighty. I believe that it's always better when you can't take credit for it because it gives glory where glory is due. In my faith, you're put here on earth to glorify God. When you glorify yourself, it's not a healthy thing. It doesn't mean you're going to be unsuccessful, but it's not a healthy thing. And I think my greatest achievements have always been because God's put something in my life that I couldn't have achieved. But now when you bring God into it, it makes sense.
So you spend a decade and a half flying helicopters, going through, sitting in the Marine Corps. What pulled at you about making the transition into medicine and the Navy?
So I'd done an airborne unit called 1st ANCO, got attached to 101st and a couple other Army units, and spent some time with the ROC Marines over in Korea. Had a really great tour, came back to the cockpit, was serving. We'd served all over the, I've been in the Persian Gulf, Africa.
You've seen the world.
I've seen the world, 50 countries. And what's interesting, I was supposed to go to JSOC, which is every guy's dream. If you're in that mentality, we like to jump out of airplanes.
Tell the kids what that means.
So that's Joint Special Operations Command in Fort Bragg. You work with Delta Force, SEAL teams. And this is right after 9/11. So everybody's wired. And this is the best military people you can work with. They're the most intelligent, hardworking, dedicated, patriotic, capable people you'll ever meet in your life. I don't care what profession you go into, you'll never find a more dedicated professional group of people
They don't mess up.
That's right. And well, We do in marriage, though. And here's more to the point. Here, I was assigned that. I was given that by my detailer. I was really excited about that. It was my dream job. And I called up a guy who was a two-star general who worked there, and he played rugby with me. He was the captain of the combined service rugby team. And I said, I'm coming your way. I'm so excited. He said, you're going to love it. It's the perfect job. But get ready, because every single person I know is going through a divorce. He said, we're gone 9 months out of the year, and when you're home, you're working long hours, at least 6 days a week. And you're going to love it. Your wife's going to hate it. Now, at the time, I had a nine-month-old, one on the way, and I'd spent about 2.5 years out of my marriage away. And so my wife was struggling. And so I thought about it, prayed about it. I was in a great Bible study group, 5 different Marine Corps families, all officers from different churches, by the way, but we met on Sunday nights, and it was meant to be. It came to me all of a sudden, I'm supposed to be an ER doc. And I've never even looked at, I don't even know what medical school is. I don't know how you get into medical school. I don't know what pre-med is. I know none of this, but I'm supposed to be an ER doc, not just a doctor, an ER doc. Now think of what it takes. Most people realize, anybody who's tried to get into medical school understands, that's a tall order, especially for a guy who never took academics seriously, a guy who had a...
It's a tough time to start learning.
Yes, and especially for a guy who never really thought about academics seriously, who had a learning disability growing up, it wasn't supposed to happen. But I called my detailer and said, hey, I think I'm going to take a different turn. I know this sounds weird because this is the job I've been begging for. And he said, well, you'll get whatever's left over because you can't... There's no other jobs left. Just the end of the cycle. All the other applications are over with. I was like, okay. So leap of faith. I said, you know, whatever happens, happens. Next day he calls me up and says, I see you have an MBA. I need a guy with an MBA at Georgia Tech in Morehouse as Marine Officer Instructor. Would you be willing to accept that? Think about that. The hand of God, literally, what are the chances of that job opening up for me and setting me up for, by the way, if you look at my whole career in this district that I'm about to represent, presumptively, the 3 tours I did in Korea, the 40,000 Koreans that are in my district, the tour I did in India with almost 100,000 Indians in my district, 1 out of every 5 doctors is Indian. And think about what that represents in my physician experience. Think about my Morehouse experience and the number of African-Americans in our district. And just think about how God literally designed my life before I even conceived politics as a viable thing to do, as something I'd even want to do, by the way. That's how God set this up. I truly believe that nothing. First of all, me getting into medical school, that's a miracle in itself. I mean, I did my pre-med at Georgia Tech with a bunch of kids way smarter than me. The average person takes about 7 times to learn something. That's why we advertise things 7 times when we pay all that money for you to remember my name. Rich McCormick, by the way, richmccormick.us. Anyways, what's funny is a physician is supposed to learn after only repeating it 3 times. Now, it takes me about 14 times. So for me to get into medical school was a miracle. And then for me to get into Emory as a residency was also a miracle because, once again, I had 3 kids. I accepted that was going to be a challenge, that I wasn't going to be first in my class. And yet I still got into one of the most competitive ER residencies in America. And it was meant to be. And then I went back in the Navy, got my experience, went back overseas and served in Afghanistan as the department head of emergency medicine there in Kandahar. And the rest was history. We came back here because my wife, who's an oncologist, I got remarried from a woman I knew in church for about 7 years. And it was meant to be. She wanted to move back here. It was just getting angry and getting put back by what all the politicians were doing, even my own party, that got me involved in politics, and the rest is history.
I'm going to ask you, I play a game with the people that I think are interesting, and some of it's to throw you off your game a little bit. So it's 5 questions. Where, and you cannot answer anything with the state of Georgia, where's the best place you were ever stationed?
I can't say Georgia. Hawaii. So Hawaii is a
Kaneohe Bay.
Perfect weather. Yeah, I got to go surfing anytime. I would surf purposely on Christmas Day. Just say I did it.
You'd send a picture to everybody.
I would. I wore basically shorts and maybe a tank top if I was wearing a shirt every day. I had a CJ5, Jeep CJ5, straight 671 or 75 with a with a bikini top, and that was perfect every day. I mean, it was, I could drive around the island, I could watch whales, I flew over sharks and whales all the time. I went to all the islands.
Were you stationed at Kaneohe Bay?
Yes.
So I was born at Castle Memorial Hospital.
My son was born at Tripler.
Yep. And so I need a good reason to go back, but I do love shave ice. When you know, but there are three people who will know the answer, who will know what we're talking about. But when you land in Honolulu, are you an H3 guy or are you a polytunnel guy?
H3 was my favorite, so that was the way I like to do it.
It landed right at the base. That was fortunate. Well, so you work nights in emergency medicine. Is the full moon real?
We think it is. The nurses are convinced of it. I'm kind of convinced of it. Who knows if people are aware of that and it just modifies their behavior, or if there really is some sort of weird thing going on. I will say that, unfortunately, we live in a time where overdoses, anxiety, depression, suicidality is a real problem. On a given night, I probably have 5 patients with those sort of problems.
When 2020 happens and you're in emergency medicine, all those people, and this is not one of the 5, but you kind of went there. Have you seen COVID change? And I don't mean like from a political issue, like when you are there in March, April, May, and it's new to everybody and you're smarter than the rest of us, even if you have to hear it 14 times, how have you seen, obviously we know a lot of different things about it today. And I don't know that it's as bad or deadly as it was to most people. But what was your experience like with that?
Well,
because it was, I'm sure it was scary.
It was very difficult because at first we had nobody in the ER. It was funny. People with heart attacks weren't coming in. People with strokes weren't coming in. And I think long term it affected a lot of people downrange. It was such a politicized, well, first of all, it's scary. Nobody knew what it was. Everybody was freaking out. And so it shut down. You remember the streets were empty. People weren't even driving. It was crazy.
Yeah. Nobody got in a car accident for months.
It was really a bizarre experience. The murders went down. The car accidents went down. I'm an ER doc. And then the heart attacks disappeared. I'm like, what am I supposed to do? And so it was really, and when I say they just stopped coming in. But it was bizarre. And then people started coming in for cold-like symptoms, because then they had the reflex of where everybody came in for everything. And so I've watched this full cycle, and I've watched this knee-jerk reaction. I've seen the politicized nature of this disease, which is really unfortunate, by the way, because it stopped being a medical conversation. It started being a political conversation. We lost our ability to discuss it with a scientific viewpoint rather than a political standpoint, and it ruined the conversation. Now people have a great distrust, not just for the government, but also a lot of physicians. Because if a physician thinks one thing, you're a Democrat. If they think another thing, you're a Republican. And it has nothing to do with science, it has to do with politics. And people won't even believe you if you don't say what they want you to say.
Yeah.
And so now it's not even a scientific discussion where we can learn and grow. And by the way, what we learned on how to treat this disease has evolved drastically.
I'm sure.
What we learned is the final outcome versus where we started has changed drastically. In other words, for example, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but I'm not a mandate guy either. I'm that balanced guy.
We agree. And I got one because they told me I could get back on an airplane, and then it mutated. And I was like, well, that was fruitless.
Well, and let me get that. So when it first came out, if you had not had the disease and you're of high risk, there was serious benefit for getting a vaccination, in my opinion, my scientific, just based on the data. But over time, let's fast forward 2 years, everybody's been exposed to this disease, everybody, and probably multiple times. Even whether you're vaccinated or unvaccinated, we all have immunity of some sort. Now you have to go back to the way we look at any other virus, whether it be the flu, which is probably a similar virus. Remember when flu came out, influenza came out 100 years ago, around 26 million people died worldwide. More people than died of this. And we had way fewer people. It was a much more deadly disease. And yet we're on, you know, hundreds of variants later. And we still get flu vaccinations for people who are high risk. So there's some benefit, but it's a modified flu vaccine. We're still on this original variant vaccination for COVID, which we now show has no benefit whatsoever. And especially for people who've been exposed over and over again, yet we still required of certain people insanely. As a matter of fact, one of my big things, I was just talking to leadership about championing a bill. I really want to champion a bill to get military people back in the military who didn't have the vaccination, who are immune.
Well, I want to ask you, that's as a kindred spirit of sorts. The military has real problems with respect to staffing. When you look around and you see different, you know, different branches offering up to $115,000 in benefits to enlist, and they can't get the number to move. And I said that this is a form of a question down the road. In April, I was in San Diego, which is, by anybody's account, about as nice a place as you can go on active duty, and went through for work with North Island, and then went to MCAS at Miramar. And I was really surprised from growing up to now how dilapidated. It's not that the cruisers and destroyers and everything, like, they're top notch. You drive through that harbor in San Diego and it is mile after mile after mile, and you think nobody would ever mess with us. But the infrastructure where people live when they're home needs help. And that to me, I was, when you look at the military conversation, how do you balance or prioritize that with respect to who you want to be, who you are, where you've been, and making that conversation make sense? Because I don't know that the infrastructure that a Lance Corporal lives in at Miramar is a partisan issue.
It's not, but we need to keep in mind a Lance Corporal is basically a high school graduate who's not even out of college yet, you know, somebody who without a college education is getting paid
$22,000 a year,
but also getting taken care of, right? And earning a skill, whether it be leadership or how to cook. It doesn't matter. You know, when I say leadership, the people who kill people overseas who are bad guys, there's a certain form of leadership that's developed during that process of turning these people into lethal warriors who do the right thing.
You don't want them to be too comfortable. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. In other words, I don't, you know, I don't, we can get carried away with, it doesn't matter. Every teacher should make $1 million. Okay, great. Sure. But we're not going to pay every teacher $1 million. Every military person deserves every kind of benefit they should get, but we're not going to give them every benefit. Let's face it. Veterans deserve everything, but we can't give them everything. We've been through this through our entire national history. Where are you going to run out of a good idea to give somebody money? Because everybody's a great story. Everybody deserves something because you're all Americans. You've all done sacrifice, and we have to be very balanced. And I go back to remember what the government's for, and remember what people are for. People are to take care of people. If you're a church, if you're a family, if you're a community, you take care of your own, especially those people who have served.
And they do a great job around military installations.
Yes,
those bodies of faith are next level.
And even outside, I mean, here in the Atlanta suburbs, there's not a lot of military installations, but I know a ton of people who are being taken care of by private institutions and way better than anything that exists in government, by the way. Way more accountability, way more efficiency, way more generosity, and I don't have to raise taxes or hire people who are GS employees who really don't give a damn about these guys.
Sure.
And actually, people that show up to work because they love veterans, that's where we need to focus. And when you want to talk about people who are active duty, we need to be laser focused on where we spend our money. We don't need to spend it just because there's military. Matter of fact, one of my biggest criticisms of the military is, just like every other military branch, is you get the end of your fiscal year and whatever you don't spend, you have to spend it or you lose your budget for next year. That is the most incredibly wasteful thing we've ever talked about. When Bill Clinton talked about reinventing government, I was so excited. I thought,
Here's a shot.
Here's a shot at reinventing how we spend money, because there's obviously a dramatic amount of money wasted at the end. And that's the
September 30th, man.
Yep. And so a lot of people make a living off that, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And because of that, we've never been able to bring that in, because people do make a living off that. And those are lobbyists, too.
Well, and the last question of the five to keep you balanced. In civilian medicine, I will not let you tell a military story. What's the strangest thing that you have removed from somebody?
I don't know if I can say that on the radio. I've removed screwdrivers from people.
Interesting objects.
Yeah, interesting objects. You know, I've seen it all, I feel like. But then tomorrow I'll see something different.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we shock you with anything?
It would be very hard. I've literally seen a person who tried to duck a taser and ended up with a taser in their eye. I've seen, I got pictures on my phone of non-identifiable people, by the way, who have some really weird, I've seen people eviscerate themselves. Literally, Harry Carey. I've seen people with psychotic disorders. I've seen horrible I've seen scarring things. And not to be lighthearted about this, because I won't be. It's actually it's a very emotional when you see some of the worst things. And this is why I always remind my nurses and staff that you're seeing people on their worst day of their life. So you're an influencer. You can get them to stop smoking. You can get them to stop being gangbangers. You can get them to start going to church, whatever. Or at least you can have that conversation with them. It's an amazing position of authority and influence, and you have to be very careful about how you wield that. You also see some of the worst things in the world. You see children die. You'll never get over that. You'll remember every single child that dies. You'll see people who accept death very, very spiritually, and you'll see people who are not spiritual,
not ready to go,
who lament that even though they've abused their bodies all their life, they don't understand why they can die. Well, you're supposed to save them, even though they've literally abused their body to the point where it cannot rebound anymore, and you can't save them from themselves, even though they've never even tried to help themselves. They want you to do your best, but they'll never do their best. So there's a lot of weird things, but I'll tell you, the success stories are what make you keep coming back. The fact that there's always some, you know, I can never save you permanently. I can maybe extend your life somewhat. When you come in dead, if we get you back, it's a bonus because you're dead. I try not to take it serious.
You do take it serious.
Sorry, I try not to take it personally.
Yeah, that's a better word.
But it's hard when you're in a war zone and you see somebody you had lunch with come in with a gut wound and bad things are happening. You're not God. So it's a very humbling experience. I constantly am exposed to people and stories that keep me human and keep me plugged in. I get to witness failed policy every single day where you get to see where the government has gone wrong. And as a result, people are suffering and going the wrong direction. And that's given me good perspective, I think, as we move forward.
Let's assume, I want to wander through the campaign, but before we get there, let's assume that you are a sitting member of Congress. You are limited in the outside jobs that you can have, but medicine is clearly, it's all over you, man. Like you, it's who you are. How do you continue to, I say, like, give in the first person? How do you, you know what I mean? Because it's a shame, because if you had, for whatever reason, the Congress went on strike for 6 months and you can't make any money or whatever, like, you should be able to go back to a hospital and do what you're trained to do. How do you see yourself staying involved in that way?
Yeah. So because medicine's unique, it's actually you're a worker. I mean, especially in the ER, you don't own your own practice. I can't blindly put it in a trust and it makes money for me. So I'm allowed to make up to, I think, $29,500 per year, which basically pays for your malpractice, I think.
Yeah.
So it's, and there's a lot of liability in that too. You have to, special rules on how you can do that as an individual contractor, because you can't be part of a group. You know, there's a lot of conflict of interest that has to be avoided. So probably the easiest way for us to deal with this is to work for the VA or the National Guard. That way I'm working for the government. I can keep my eye, by the way, on the VA. That'd be awesome.
That's a heartbreaking place, man.
It can be. And there's some success stories and there's some definite places where we can help. And for me to be directly involved one way or another, I mean, they're going to have to involve me. They can't just say, you can't come here, because I literally can go there for my medical health care. So I think it's good that I'm going to be involved in that from an oversight perspective. I think it'd be even better if I can be involved in it and actually help them improve or help them move on to something better. I think this is going to be a good opportunity to maintain my medical licensing, to maintain my
skill set,
and also keep an eye on medicine. Medicine is one of the biggest problems we're going to face in the future. It's the second largest expense for all businesses across the United States. It is increasing at an abnormal rate, even above inflationary standards. It's 9.7 last year alone percent. And if we go to a single payer system, it'll be an increase of $30 trillion $30 in the next 10 years. That's a conservative estimate. $30 trillion. You do the math. Remember, we're all worried about that $30 trillion debt we have right now?
We have now that we took almost $300 years
yes.
to do.
And imagine in the next decade adding another $30 trillion to that in expense or debt, which would be catastrophic. And by the way, that doesn't mean better health care. As a matter of fact, we've seen the only good single-payer system we have is the VA. So do your math on that one. Realize where the waste is. It's kind of like when we say, oh, we're going to help everybody out by forgiving them $10,000 worth of debt, as if that fixes the tuition problem.
Right.
We keep on approaching this from the absolute wrong end of history. Well, we, meaning the Democrats, not we. But they double down on failure. That's why New York and California are failing miserably, even though they have more resources, industry, diversity, everything. They have every kind of advantage, and they've been expanding by record numbers for the last 200 years. And all of a sudden, they're contracting. Why? Because of a bad government. And then they double down on their bad government.
Let's do some more.
Yeah,
it
makes no sense.
We can dig out. Well, when you – so you decide probably 2 years ago to run for Georgia 6. And I know that there's lines that get redrawn in some former process with – people that I don't really have anything to do with, and you wind up, what pulled at you about running for Congress?
It was getting angry.
Enough.
I was not a political guy, but I went down to the Capitol with a bunch of doctors to solve surprise billing, which affects over half of Americans, where you go to the doctor or you go to the emergency room and then you get a bill.
And you have no idea what it's going to say.
What the hell? You know, I have insurance. Why am I getting this bill? Because there's some disagreement between the insurance company and your provider. And now you get, during the worst time in your life, you're now stuck with a bill. Now you have to figure out how to arbitrate it. And we as physicians realize instinctively, that's a bad thing for us because we don't want that to affect our patient relationship. And first of all, we don't want the patients to be burdened with that. That we're all going to be patients someday. So we went down to the Capitol with a very bipartisan, patient advocacy-backed bill that we thought was great. And it was my own party that really kind of betrayed us, that was involved in special interests. And as a result, I was very angry at lunch. I was like, this is ridiculous. We need to solve this. And so a bunch of people said, well, if you're that excited about it, why don't you run for office? We'll help set you up. And it was a rocky start. I've gone through a lot to kind of learn. You know, I mean, just figuring out how to raise money when you have no money. I mean, I'm a military guy all my life. I don't have a bunch of money.
Not a big sales background.
Yeah. And also no connections. Never knew a politician before I did this. Didn't know one politician. Never been involved in a campaign. Never done any of this. And then, you know, my first campaign, I was going against Renee Unterman, who is my state senator, who hadn't lost a race in 33 years, in the 7th before it was reapportioned. And we had 11 candidates in that at one time. 11 people had run for that office at one. And we ended up winning, you know, handily without a runoff. And so it was like, you know, we got a great team. We got a great message. And then when we reapportioned us, they took about 40% of our district and put in the new 6th. And they took about 40% of the old 6th, about 20% of the 9th and 11th. All of a sudden, you had this great representative district, and I was really excited about it. It wasn't perfectly drawn. I don't think anybody took me into account, which is fine.
And I'd argue they shouldn't.
That's right. That's right. But I think, you know, when you know, everybody has their idea of what that district should look like, and everybody lobbied for what they thought that it should be. It turns out it's one of the largest suburban areas in a Republican-owned district. Well, actually, we don't own it. Lucy McBeth technically owns it, but it will be flipped. We're excited about this. It's such a diverse district from rural, you know, Dawson and Forsyth and Cherokee, all the way down to very suburban North Forsyth and Cobb. I love it. I think it's exactly the diversity that I've been prepared for. I believe that this is our opportunity to grab back lost ground, to appeal to a wide variety of people, because it's not just about winning, but about expanding a party in a very healthy way. We've been too often worried about winning, and then when you realize you're going to win your election, you back off. I look at this like almost like a church experience. We have a message that appeals to all people, like Reagan. Reagan was a great messenger. He expanded the kingdom, if you will, by saying
from California.
Yeah, by saying, look, this is good for all people, not just some people, not just for a majority, but for all people. This is an opportunity. We can grow the pie. We can make sure that everybody's successful, everybody's benefited, that everybody has the American dream promised to them and can fulfill that. And if we do that, we're never done. We're never done expanding our influence. We're never done with the last Bible study. We're never done with the last person coming to church. We're never long done with the last person coming to the Republican Party and being part of this, no matter what they look like, no matter what their religious background is, no matter where they came from. This is an experience made for all people because we are empowering you over a government. That's what made America unique, and that's what's going to make us successful into the future. And the more we preach that, the more we grab back lost ground, and I think we'll get the popular election back. Yes, I love the Electoral College, but there's no reason we shouldn't be winning a popular election, which we haven't won in 20 years nationally.
When you get into a runoff with Jake Evans, who you've told me, and I think is a great, he's a good guy. When you get into that runoff and you have the president decide to wade in against your opponent, do you feel like that liberates you a little bit where so many people are still beholden to him?
Yeah, well, let's take a step back on that. Realize that President Trump and Newt Gingrich endorsed me in 2020. They did not badmouth me in this election. Now, we know why Jake was endorsed. We understand.
It's a country club.
We understand Randy. Everybody, every single endorsement he got started with Randy Evans is blah, blah, blah. Well, Randy's not running for office, right?
And hasn't.
And let's get down to it. You're right. We were endorsed against by Trump, Gingrich, Hannity, Pompeo, Matt Schlapp and CPAC, Patel, Barr, you name it. And I think the dad put a considerable amount of money involved in this race. We know this. To come out with a 2-1 victory is a statement that, you know, the voters are aware that that's not what's important. Endorsements mean something when you're trying to raise money. Endorsements mean something for a small percentage of people who are dedicated to a name that's not you.
Correct.
You are defined only by yourself. And in the end, if I look at you and I say, how are you going to vote? And you look at somebody else to see how you're going to vote, that's not my representative, is it? I want to know that you care more about me as a constituent than somebody that's endorsing you. I want to know that you're actually listening to me rather than following somebody else's lead. I want to know that you're my representative. I think that's what we bring to the table. We have a huge amount of experience from a lot of different areas of life, whether it be from my MBA or from my experience all over the world, my military experience, my medical experience. This is something that I think we've been able to get out there, and also the relationships. Think about how I've been prepared for this very diverse district. And I think it's an authentically prepared thing, but that I could not control, that I wasn't, you know, gearing for politics. I didn't get raised as a politician.
Right.
I got raised as a warrior that believes in this great country, that loves his country, and that wants to see his country benefited. This is not about me.
When you got called weak-kneed.
I love that, by the way.
Oh, and I was like, do they have any idea who the hell this guy
Mistake.
Is?
Mistake. Yeah, never call a rugby Marine weak-kneed. I love that. And it was right before,
Murph. I was like, oh.
Yeah, and right during a military holiday, I was like, okay, let's you know, right after my shift, we did the Murph Challenge. I was like, come on, bring it. Let's see who's weak-kneed. And I didn't see any response that day for some reason.
There's a point where, and everybody who's ever run for office and knew that they were going to win, like you feel yourself go over the mountain. You're like, oh, that was the day. When I saw that, I was like, does he have any idea what that guy's background is?
Oh, by the way, let's get back to Trump and those guys. President Trump and I have a great relationship. And you'll see in the near future that's going to come to fruition. And also, same thing with Newt Gingrich. That's going to be healed. You know, that's...
Yeah.
CPAC had us out to speak.
So, I was going to say, and then they called you to speak.
Exactly. So this is politics. I get it. You have to have thick skin. You have to understand that in the end, the voters got it right. Obviously, I feel that way.
I did too, and whatever it was, June, May,
but
May.
But that's the one thing. Sometimes we don't think the voters are very smart, and some voters maybe aren't. But I think when you really, this is where we have to educate. I think the more we educate the voters, the more they're going to vote with us on everything. And this is where that that authentic conversation, not me trying to trick them into something, me promising them something, but me giving them historical perspective and a scientific approach to everything we're doing, that what works, works. And it's not about Rich McCormick works. It's about this works.
Yeah, it's ideology.
Yes. And the more we focus on the good things that benefit people and less on politicians, because this isn't about politicians. This is about people. And the more we make it about the success story of America, what made this country truly the best country in the world, worth giving my life, worth my son's joining the military and giving their life. The more we make this about an authentic conversation about what will benefit you and your children, the more we're going to win people over to something that's good for all of us.
Two questions to end, and they are both foreign policy related. And I told you we'd get there. Sure. Everybody's taken their Ukrainian flag off their Facebook page, and I poke at all of them all the time. What is the answer there in America's role for the world? Because it is clearly, you of all people know this, it is not. There are no boots on the ground. Russia is still clearly an enemy, and we do not know that. I mean, Russia wages war on the United States every day with cyber infrastructure and everything else. Do you feel like the administration's tone towards them, which has been bipartisanly supported, do you feel like it is the right way to handle a nefarious actor?
So, this is a very complex issue that a lot of people like to simplify. And by the way, one of the things that I would challenge our party to do, because our party gets idealistic to the point where we start talking.
You can't see.
Well, yeah, you're talking about defunding the FBI. Well, that's defunding the police. You know, we're a party that we knee jerk sometimes, just like everybody else. You know, the FBI, are they perfect? No, not at all. Is leadership perfect? Far from it, and may even be a big part of the problem. But the FBI has also protected us from a lot of bad guys since 9/11. It's a miracle that we haven't had another major attack on American soil since then. And that's a testimony to those three-letter organizations that we're so critical of. I have several Marines that I served with that are in the FBI. And they're good guys. They're patriots. They're not calling the shots. And don't let one incident make you, you know, distasteful towards an organization. Same thing with these overseas things. Now realize, okay, let's get into
don't take China, because that's my last question.
Okay,
take this one.
Let's get into this isolationist mentality that a lot of Republicans are getting now. Oh, we need not let any immigration for the next year. Shut it all down. Well, that's not really effective when you have a negative growth rate.
Correct. And a declining population.
And the only people coming here are illegal. The last thing you want to do is shut down legal immigration, because now, once again, you're punishing the people who do it right. And you're just encouraging more illegals to come in here and fill jobs you need filled. Come on, guys. Think about what scientifically works. Think about what makes sense. Not just ideology that's just extreme, that doesn't work. Think about things that work. Don't be in isolations where I'm not going to get involved with anybody in the world. We're not going to spend any of our GDP on foreign aid. Well, that's how Trump effectively stopped wars. He kept us out of Syria because he used the money that we used with Turkey to keep them from attacking, because he said, if you dare, you're done. We're cutting you off. So without one person getting involved in a war, which a lot of people were hawkish on, by the way, both Democrats and Republicans.
Always are.
He kept us out of that war because he used our investment overseas to keep them out. What he did with Israel, which is brilliant, by the way.
Get all your enemies.
And I will say, I try to be very honest with every politician, including President Trump, that he did a brilliant job with Israel, because he literally took our financial leverage and created a lasting peace. I think this is going to be the only peace brokerage that's going to last, because what he did, he financially tied these nations together. That has never been done before.
No, free trade partners don't typically fight with each
other.
Think
about that. Once you realize that these people are making money for me and everybody's benefiting from me, all of a sudden it breaks down those barriers that are thousands of years old. Like, well, these guys are actually helping me, and this is an honest deal. Now all of a sudden, wow, there's prosperity, and people are like, well, this can work. And that was something that could only be done because we had financial investments in the, all those countries, Oman, UAE, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Israel. You know, when you have that sort of influence, you can do that. Without that investment, that's still a war. And so when we talk about staying out of any other country, look, we can be isolationists. And I respect my libertarian brothers because I lean libertarian in many ways.
You've got that streak.
I do. But at the same time, isolationism has never worked in the history of mankind. Every country who's became isolationist has dwindled and gone away. China was the world power back in the 15th century. They circumnavigated the globe before Magellan did. Do your history. I'm serious. They've been around the world. They had a much wealthier empire than anybody in Europe at the time. And then somewhere during the Manchurian dynasty, they decided to become isolationists. They got rid of all their history. They decided to get away from the rest of the world.
They built a wall.
And they became obscure.
Yeah.
They went away in history. And the only way that China has now become, and now we're transitioning.
No.
Only way that they became relevant again is now that they're investing. They're investing in the world in huge ways, and all of a sudden they're relevant again. So don't think that we as the United States are going to become more relevant or more healthy by becoming isolationist. So getting back to Ukraine, we can't ignore things. We can't just say, oh, it's okay for Russia to do what they did back when we were allowing what Hitler did, right? We can't just say, oh, it's okay. Do whatever you want to because I don't want to get involved. That's never, ever, ever worked. Now, I'm not saying we're going to put boots on the ground. As a matter of fact, my opponent did at one time. Then he tried to renege on that. But it's on video. You can actually go back and actually see it. But we're past that race.
Yeah, if they shoot a certain kind of weapon, there's not a lot left anywhere.
That's right. But let's look at how missile systems are working. How I think Ukraine's going to win this. I think that they're becoming more strategic in their approach to this. When you use a missile system that can actually be deployed, you fire one missile and then you move the whole missile system on a truck that costs about $5.1 million per pop, and you send about a dozen of them over there. You spend another dozen over there, and you combine that with oversight of unmanned vehicles, and then you also combine that with Javelin systems, they become a very deadly force against the Russians. And when you combine that with intelligence, they're faltering. And yeah, they're going to win their battles because they have an overwhelming military force, but it is a great equalizer when you have Stingers and Javelins and HIRAMs, and you're actually taking out Russian centers. And by the way, their tactics have not developed. They are the same Iraqi tactics that failed before, and they're going to be in the hurt locker against a very determined Ukrainian opponent, and I think they're going to lose.
Well, I do too, ultimately. But the other thing about Russia is, and people don't know this unless you've been over there, it's a third world country with a first-ish, we thought it was a first-ish world military, but it's not. You look at their GDP, I mean, outside of natural gas, if they don't have a bunch of supply partners, they're in trouble fast.
That's why they folded as the Soviet Union before. They don't have a good infrastructure. Socialism doesn't work. Communism certainly doesn't work.
And those people aren't loyal when you're starving to death.
Heck no. And I'll go the next step too. Why even go on the side of Ukraine? Well, first of all, realize that Putin was part of the KGB during the Soviet Union era. He wants to bring back that era of glory, of prestige. He will not be satisfied with that. There's a reason that the Nordic countries want to join NATO for the first time in history. And people are like, no, don't let him in. It's going to provoke Russia. No.
Trade partners, let's do it.
Wrong. I mean, Finland fought a war against Russia, the Winter War, where they defeated the Russians very handily, even though they had nobody really. They didn't have the mechanized tanks or infantry that the Russians had, and they beat them badly. But you know, we have an opportunity right now to shore up allies in that area that will keep them in check and also maybe bring them to the table. Reagan made a good point that you don't negotiate through weakness, you negotiate through strength. And if you allow them to take Ukraine without helping these people that don't want to be part of Russia, by the way, realize that I think it was 1922 that Ukraine was one of the first people to join the Soviet Union willingly. But they also have decided to leave Russia and they don't want to be part of that anymore. And they're they're stout fighters. They're smart. They're I got some buddies that get over there right now. You know, we got some special
through
operators.
Through various contracts and sort of things.
And privately funded, I'm pretty sure. But I will tell you that these guys are a determined enemy, just like the special operations guys were in Afghanistan, who are just as patriotic, just as freedom-loving, just as good of people as we are here in America. That freedom that God put in our hearts, that to seek our own self-destiny, is universal. Don't think that it's unique to America. It is unique to all people. It's just that it gets pushed down. When a woman will literally, when I was in Afghanistan, one of the things that impressed me is a woman to go vote would actually prepare herself for burial. So if they got killed, murdered by Taliban on the way to vote, they could just be buried. That's that inner burning for freedom that you can, no American can even comprehend that. I would prepare, I'm getting ready to go die just to have the right to vote and self-determine. In Afghanistan, in a country you've been brought up and subjugated to essential slavery, where you can't have an opportunity to work or be educated or to raise your kids the way you want to, and then you have to do everything your husband tells you to, I'm willing to give my life to go vote. That is hopeful for me, no matter what country we're talking about. People want that. They yearn for it. It's natural. It's ingrained in our soul. And that's what this is about.
Last question. My youngest child is adopted from China. Did it 5 years ago. I'm not sure that I would have that opportunity today with the geopolitical politics, but I love him. Hey, James, he's six. He's not really a listener of the show. It's not on Disney Plus. He won't do it. But he... You know, he's I learned through him that people are people all over the world. But what has happened with them, with the Chinese government over there, and that they put on a show. You go adopt a child over there, man. I came back and I was like, they got a bullet train and they got the best food you could ever have. And like, it is, if it's state run, there's no question. But I was like, if it's going to be state run, they'd do it right. This will publish in a few weeks, so I'm gonna do it. A couple weeks ago, and by that I mean yesterday, I read on Fox News that the Solomon Islands denied a U.S. Coast Guard. You know, they were investigating, you know, fisheries around the South China Sea and the Pacific Ocean. Would not let the United States Coast Guard come refuel, and I thought. And so you read the next article and how much money China has been pumping into those allies, quote unquote allies overseas, for a country that sits under the British monarch to not allow a United States sanctioned vessel to put unleaded in the tank. Says a lot more to, is as much to me as it does them building islands out in the middle of the ocean so that they can expand, but they are investing in the Pacific Rim. How do you see in your challenge if you are sitting in the United States Congress dealing with a nation that year over year, that relationship, which used to be relatively healthy, has deteriorated to a place exponentially in the last few years to where, is that a relationship we would even want to save? And if we didn't, how do you want to combat staying relevant in that part of the world? Because I do think it matters.
Yeah, so this is a really, first of all, thank you for adopting. I think that's a really important part of just being human. My best friend in the Marine Corps, one of my best friends, adopted two girls from China.
If you asked me if I'd do it again, I'd tell you no. But I did it once.
I will say that his daughters are beautiful and successful, and Charlotte and Olivia have been. They're going to make great Americans, and they're both in college now. So
the best. Yeah. They will make the best.
Yeah, and they get. And if you teach them well, you also teach them how lucky they were to get to America. Thank God for them, right? But I will say China is not, once again, you can't, this is where we get oversimplified, right? It's very easy for us to say as Republicans, don't do anything with the Russians. I hate them, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, same thing with China, you know.
They have a billion people. They're an eighth of the world's population, if not more.
And so the question is, how do we handle this very complex issue without being extremists and unrealistic? Let's be realistic about it. Let me talk about what they bring to the table right now that we have to be careful about. They own about 80% of the known natural resources that we need for the future. You know, the lithium, the rare
Earth
metals that create chips and batteries. Two things that America is the biggest consumer by far in the world. They, by the way, process 90% of that. Even the stuff that they don't have comes to China to be processed into chips and into batteries and everything else.
And if you don't want to pay $9,000 for your iPhone, they're a trade part.
And so we have to, first of all, start there. Realize that whether we want to or not, they are a big part of our future unless you want to go to war and take them over, which good luck. So that's not realistic. So let's take that off the table. Let's realize that in the future, if we want to have, just like Saudi Arabia, wouldn't we have been great to just leave them and say, screw you guys, we don't like your extremist, we're not going to give you any money for your oil. But they had a large portion of the world's oil. And so, yeah, we could be independent, but do we want to just use the United States oil? This was a very complex question. Oh, by the way, do we want to tie them into us with a monarchy that maybe wasn't the perfect ally, but a whole hell of a lot better than if the extremists took over and created a theocracy in Saudi Arabia? We stabilized that region by certain investments, and probably thank God, otherwise we would have been isolated over there, especially once Iraq went south and Iran the way it is. Think about the strategic approach we have to each country. Now look at China. We have India over there. By the way, I love having them as a strong ally. We need them in that region, just like we need Israel in the Middle East. India has more people, it has industry, it has a strong immigration population, especially here in my district. They can be used as a resource for trading partners in a lot of things that China produces, by the way. So let's shore that up first. We need them as a strong ally there. We need China to not cut us off from those things that make us successful as a country. If you want to buy a car in the future, it's probably going to have about 25 computer chips in it produced in China. That's the reality of it. And you could say, oh, chips, let's make sure all the chips are made here. Well, where are you going to get the resources for those chips? Probably from China, unless you're going to rely on the 10% of the world that doesn't have that doesn't, and by the way,
and then you need it all.
Yeah, exactly. You need all their stuff. Nobody else can buy from them, which means, like you said, now your iPhone costs $9,000, your car costs $30,000 more than it originally. So now your $30,000 car costs $60,000. Your $60,000 costs $100,000. We have to be realistic in how we approach this. Ideally, it'd be better not to go to war with China. And if we isolate them too much, we will have a problem because I think they're going to go into Taiwan. They've been talking about it for decades. Soon as I was in Hong Kong before it fell. When it fell, before it was turned over.
Yeah, I gotcha. When it was British-ish. Yeah,
it was British. And I was there after. And in some ways, it was not a big deal. In other ways, it was a very big deal. But one of the things that they said right after...
Beautiful place.
Right? Yeah, I love Hong Kong. It used to be where all my suits were made until my staff said, you have to update your 90s repertoire to something that actually fits you like it's supposed to. Who knew? I met my wife in these clothes. It's still not good. But anyways, when they got done taking over Hong Kong, they literally said, Taiwan's next. It belongs to us. This is a problem that we're facing because Taiwan's an ally. Just like, by the way, we are linked to Ukraine by a document that says we're supposed to help them out in these times. And you can't just walk away from that and say, we're okay with that. Same thing with Taiwan. We are linked to them through allyship that has certain requirements. Now, where that starts and ends is a little bit gray, but we have to be very strategic in how we approach this because going to war with China, it would be catastrophic for everybody. I mean, they're a nuclear power.
Everybody.
Yeah. And although we have probably nuclear subs off their coast, they probably have subs off our coast too, quite frankly, at this point. And if they don't, they will in the future. Mutual destruction is never a good end for any war. And so this is something we're going to have to figure out with them. We have to be very careful not to make any extreme remarks, that we don't box ourselves into a very bad decision because we're being based on an ideology rather than on a reality. So I want to be very careful on how we... I do see China as our greatest threat to us economically, militarily. In every way, they are our biggest threat, but they are also a necessary partner in advancing world peace, if you will. So I think we have to be very careful to approach them with both eyes open, to strategically come at this so that we don't put ourselves in a position where we will fail economically. And they by the way, them failing and us failing simultaneously is not a good option either.
For everybody else.
That's right. And so we got to be careful, because when people start failing, people get desperate, and that's when wars break out.
So I will end here. You, Dr. Commander, Marine pilot, Navy doctor, after, you know, assuming that you sit in Congress, I feel like you will have done absolutely everything. Is your next goal like to go win a national championship as a football coach, or what do you?
You know, whatever God calls me to. You know, the fact that,
don't give me that answer. I want to be like, yeah, I want a big national championship ring.
I want to win back Congress in a great way. We're going to invest in getting this freshman class involved in big ways. We're going to stop the madness. Game, you know, day one, we got to be able to stop the madness that's going on, stop these spending sprees, get our national budget under control, start thinking about the future for our children. And then from there, let's talk about the next step of getting the presidency back, expanding the party so we can win a popular vote for the first time in 20 years, getting a clear message, just like Reagan did, of making people feel proud to be American again, of getting reining back in these problems, whether it be opioid addiction. I have a ton of ideas on immigration, healthcare, opioid overdoses, things that are in my wheelhouse. I feel like I can very much bring to the table things that will motivate people to do the right things, which is ultimately the way we solve this, is not by government regulation, but by empowering people to do the right thing, whether it be in healthcare or immigration or addiction. We can empower people to solve this problem without overreach and regulation and taxation by governments, because we shouldn't turn back to the government once again to solve the very problems they created. I'm excited about that challenge. After that, then we'll talk about me manning that space shuttle to Mars for Elon Musk and anything else that might come our way. I mean, then we'll talk about those things.
Well, I appreciate you coming and sitting. The next time I do this, and the answer has to be yes, the next time we sit down and do this, I would like it to be Lambeau Field cold in Washington, D.C., on top of the Capitol Rotunda, me and you, shorts and a t-shirt. I want to see if you're weak-kneed.
Come to the gym anytime. I mean, let's go to the rugby fields. We got a few more tournaments to play. My goal is to play a couple more tournaments as a congressman and to leave with a national championship.
Yeah, forget the congressional softball game.
That's right. Let's get a rugby game. I look forward to that.
You might draft differently. They got some Democrats who are in pretty good shape.
They do. But we got some good help on the way.
Well, we will. I'll see you up there when it's, blustery cold. I want it to be miserable.
That's one thing I always like to say is I wish it sucked more. We only find out who we are through adversity. We only get to rise to the occasion through adversity. And by the way, no good story is ever written when it's easy.
Rich McCormick, thanks for coming in. It's been another episode of the Ben Burnett Show. Have a great day, everybody.
Thanks to my friends at Solomon Brothers. You can find them at 17th Floor Tower Place in Buckhead or at Liberty Park Village off Old Milton Parkway in Alpharetta.
Spring is here and baseball is back.
You can't forget the Derby. I love the hats. Do you have yours yet?
My hat? I treated myself to a whole outfit.
If you want to be able to treat yourself, then you should check out the Nest Savings Account at LGE Community Credit Union, where they want you to reach your savings goals faster.
Take it from a pair of 680 The Fan wives. Head to lgeccu.org to find out what makes their team number one in Georgia.
The Fan is ready for Braves season. Are you?
3-1 smoked high in the air, deep center field, and heading for the horizon. A home run by Olsen.
We're streaming every game of the Braves 2024 season free on the 680 The Fan app.
So make sure you download it now and don't miss a pitch of the Braves this season.